welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian Lebeau of Creighton University's Department of History. This week, the nation celebrates Martin Luther King Jr. Day, and to mark that event, Talking History's Dennis Mihalik will be talking with Claiborne Carson about King and the civil rights movement he led. But first, let's take a look at an important event from this week in history. This week in 1973, the United States Supreme Court handed down its landmark Roe v. Wade decision, which legalized abortion. The court struck down a Texas law that made abortion a criminal offense on the ground that the law violated a woman's constitutional right to privacy under the 14th Amendment. It stipulated that in the first and second trimesters of pregnancy, the state's power to regulate abortion was either non-existent or subordinate to a woman's right to decide the question of birth or abortion for herself. Only in the third trimester, Justice Harry Blackmun's majority opinion continued, might the state prohibit abortion, and even then, it could not prohibit abortion to save the life or to protect the health of the mother. Turning items of historical interest in the news, hours after President John Kennedy was assassinated in November 1963, FBI agents listened to a tape recording of a phone call made weeks before to the Soviet embassy in Mexico City by a man who identified himself as Lee Oswald. The FBI knew that Kennedy's assassin had been in Mexico City, and based largely on that phone call, they believed that while there, he had made contact with a KGB agent in charge of Soviet sabotage and assassination. Recently declassified and released documents report, however, that upon their listening more carefully to the recording, the FBI realized that the voice on the tape was not Oswald's, but that of an imposter. No explanation has ever been offered. The family of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. finally has what it has sought for years, a jury verdict saying the civil rights leader was the victim of a murder conspiracy. The verdict resulted from a suit brought by the Kings against Lloyd Jowers, a retired Memphis businessman who has long claimed that he paid someone other than James Earl Ray, the convicted killer, to assassinate King. William Pepper, the King's lawyer, told the jury that Jowers, now 73, was part of a vast conspiracy to kill King involving the Mafia, the FBI, the CIA, the news media, Army intelligence, as well as state and local officials. You're listening to Talking History.
There'll be no more weeping and wailing.
Oh, Lord, there'll be no more weeping and wailing.
Oh, Lord, there'll be no more weeping and wailing.
Oh, Lord,
I'm going
far to hear with God, my Lord.
This week we celebrate Martin Luther King Jr. Day, the only national holiday named for an African American. To mark that event, we welcome Creighton historian Dennis Mihalik, who spoke with King scholar Claiborne Carson.
On January 17th, the United States honors the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. with a national holiday. Here to give us perspective on the man and the civil rights movement he led is Claiborne Carson, professor of history at Stanford, the director of the Martin Luther King Project, and the editor and author of numerous books and articles on King and on the civil rights movement, including The Autobiography of Martin Luther King, Jr., published by Warner Brooks. Welcome, Dr. Carson.
Good to talk to you.
How and why did Martin Luther King emerge as the leader of the civil rights movement in the United States?
Well, I think, first of all, you'd have to define your terms. I think certainly he was one of many leaders in the movement. I think he was the preeminent one because he was, I think he brought together a great many skills. First of all, he was a grassroots leader. He was a preacher in Montgomery and in Atlanta. But I think also his role was that he translated the goals of the Southern struggle into terms that people all over the United States, white and black, and all over the world could understand. So I think he was both a leader at the local level, but also a leader at the national and international level. And very few other leaders brought together that combination of skills. There were other great grassroots leaders like Fred Shuttlesworth or, there's so many that we could name. And there were others who kind of were the spokespersons for the movement at the national level, but very few did both roles.
Mm-hmm. In many people's minds, the civil rights movement is almost equated with Martin Luther King. Do you think there would have been a civil rights movement without him?
Oh, of course, of course. There was a movement before he came along, and there was a movement after his death. I think that when you look at the major stages in the movement, the Montgomery bus boycott, for example, would not have happened if not for Rosa Parks, if not for E.D. Nixon, if not for Joanne Robinson. So many other people made possible that movement. We have to remember that Martin Luther King did not become the leader of the Montgomery bus boycott until it was already a successful movement. The boycott had already begun and had already gained almost 100% backing from the local community before Martin Luther King became the leader. So I think we always should remember that we wouldn't be talking about Martin Luther King today if not for the role of people like Rosa Parks.
Some scholars have argued that by the time of his untimely death, his assassination, that King was already losing influence. How would you assess that statement?
Well, I think to a certain extent that was the case, although I think that sometimes his influence was exaggerated even before that. I think, just as you said, oftentimes the press and many interpreters saw the movement as King and his followers did this or that, when in fact many of the people described as his followers were not following him at all. You have many of the great struggles of that period taking place with very little participation on the part of Martin Luther King. For example, the Mississippi voting rights movement. King was hardly involved in that at all. The sit-in movement. King was also had very little involvement in that movement. So I think that oftentimes his influence was exaggerated, and I think that became even more evident with the emergence of the Black Power struggle. I think even the notion of describing it as a civil rights movement, I prefer to use the term Black Freedom Struggle, because I think there was always a wide variety of goals. Certainly King represented a very important aspect of that movement, but there were many people involved who were moving in a variety of different directions. I think when we look at something like the Mississippi movement, the struggle there was quite different than it was in Montgomery or in Atlanta. So I think that we sometimes misinterpret the movement when we try to use a single term like civil rights struggle to describe something that wasn't always just about getting civil rights legislation. Sometimes it was about jobs. Sometimes it was about other issues like political power at the local level. So I think we need to have a broader conception of that movement. And that also helps us understand that the movement didn't begin in 1955 with Montgomery or 1954 with the Brown versus Board of Education decision. That in many communities, we can look at lots of other activities that were going on before that. And in many communities, a lot of activities, movement activities, were going on long after the mid-1960s. So I think that when we look at King, we should see him in some ways in the same way we see Nelson Mandela as a symbol of a much broader struggle. But obviously, the South African struggle did not rely on Nelson Mandela because he was in prison for 30 years. I think in a similar way, King became the visible symbol for something that was much broader, much deeper rooted, and which would have happened even if King had never lived. I think that it's certainly a misconception to to think that black Americans would never have carried on a successful struggle against the Jim Crow system in the South if Martin Luther King, for example, had died after he was stabbed in New York in 1958. I think that that's just a misreading of history. It's kind of the great man theory of history.
Is this a media construction then? I mean, was he a media darling that they latched onto?
Well, he had certain unique qualities that made it so. I mean, a lot of other people tried to be the media darling. And certainly his ability, as I said, to be both a tremendous leader at the local level, but also to articulate the goals of the struggle in a language that has rarely been equaled, would lead any smart journalist to rush to Martin Luther King for a quote, even when you're talking about a movement like Birmingham, where Fred Shuttlesworth might be the more active player. But King would certainly be the person who could articulate the goals of the struggle and relate those goals to certain universal principles in a way that no one else before and since had done so well. So I think that was his distinctive quality, is in terms of expressing those goals in terms that had universal significance, of taking something that might have been just a local movement about integrating lunch counters and turning it into something of worldwide significance. That was an important achievement.
Yes, and probably his most famous articulation, of course, is the I Have a Dream speech. And I did note that the concluding chapter of your autobiography of Dr. King is titled Unfulfilled Dreams. What's unfulfilled?
Well, I as you realize in that book, I'm the editor, and it's really Martin Luther King's phrase that he used. It's drawn from a sermon that he gave late in his life. And I think it symbolized for me the way in which King himself saw his life at the end, and that is that the dream had not been fulfilled. Right now, King is celebrated, and the speech is used as if it is almost a celebration of how America has triumphed over racism, when the person who used that phrase to think of Martin Luther King as struggling for something that was in the past rather than something that is still with us today. The types of changes that he was calling for in 1967 and 1968 have still not been achieved. So I think that anyone who truly admires him needs to understand that imposes a burden on us today to continue to work toward achieving these goals.
Okay. Now, you mentioned the sermons. You also have out an anthology of sermons that Dr. King gave, and you titled that work Knock at Midnight. What does that title allude to, and why did you choose it for the title of the anthology?
Well, again, as so often with King, when you try to understand his life, you go first to the sermons. And when I brought together the volume of his sermons, Knock at Midnight, the title comes from one of the sermons that he gives. Like many of the sermons, it's a pessimistic and hard-driving sermon in the sense that it imposes some responsibility on the listener. It challenges the listener to recognize that overcoming evil in the world is not an easy task, and it can't be done quickly. The knock at midnight is the recognition that we are all at midnight in the social order, that we are all always faced with the reality of social evil and the difficulty of overcoming it. And I think that what I see in King's, many of King's speeches and in his sermons, is a sense that the struggle is never ending, that the goal of that he was trying to achieve cannot be encapsulated in a single piece of civil rights legislation or anti-poverty legislation. It really has to do with the nature of the human heart, and therefore it's a constant struggle. It's a constant struggle against both the external evil and the evil within each of us. That he understood that we all have our good and our bad side, our side that tends toward toward God, our side that tends toward evil. And the struggle is both an internal struggle and an external struggle, and it has to be ongoing. It has to be seen as a lifelong struggle.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of the struggles, there was a major struggle in getting a national holiday adopted in his honor. What's the significance in terms of a national holiday honoring Dr. King?
Well, I think that that's still being decided by Americans. I think it was an important accomplishment, and I give most of the credit here to Coretta Scott King, who I think played a crucial role in bringing about the King holiday and struggled for it for many years. But I think having achieved it, now it's up to those of us who admired and were inspired by King to define what it means. And for me, and what I try to argue for when I speak on the King holiday, is understanding his role as a symbol for something much larger. First of all, I don't consider it a holiday for an individual. It's a holiday that represents one of the great freedom struggles of human history. It's a struggle that has inspired freedom struggles throughout the world and continues to inspire them. Even this year, you know, there are going to be people in many parts of the world singing "We Shall Overcome," and understanding King as a heroic figure in their struggle. I think it's important to understand that it's not a black holiday, that King probably had at least as many white admirers and admirers who were not Americans as he had black admirers. And I think that that is something that should be. And, you know, it represents what King was really talking about. He was not talking about black people freeing themselves. He was talking about the struggle of human beings to achieve a higher level of civilization. And that's something that helps us get over this notion of that somehow it's a concession to black people, or that white people have no place in the celebration of Martin Luther King. So I think that the holiday at its best can be an educational opportunity for Americans to understand more about our own history.
And on that point, unfortunately, we'll have to end our conversation. I want to thank our guest, Professor Claiborne Carson of Stanford University and the director of the Martin Luther King Project.
I was standing by my window on a cold and cloudy day when I saw the good summer gone.
With all that's been said about the civil rights movement, how many of us ever pause to recall its religious roots, even though we all know it was led, at least for a while, by the Reverend Martin Luther King, Jr.? Professor James Farrell has, and he's offered to share with us his thoughts on the subject. Professor Farrell teaches American Studies at St. Olaf College, and he's the author of The Spirit of the 60s, published by Routledge Press.
One of the functions of American national holidays is to celebrate people who espouse dangerous ideas without actually celebrating the ideas. The Martin Luther King holiday may be headed in that direction. It's not yet a major shopping day with its celebrations, but it tends to celebrate an American hero who doesn't make anybody uncomfortable anymore. Increasingly, our holidays commemorate a radical past by making sure that it has no impact on the present. In an increasingly secular society, too, we tend to forget the religious roots of much of American radicalism. But the civil rights movement was nothing if not religious. On the King holiday, therefore, it might be useful to think briefly about the religious roots of the civil rights movement. American activists in the civil rights movement drew on the religious traditions of the Black Folk Church, the social gospel, Gandhian nonviolence, and American personalism to enunciate a vision of justice and activism that would become increasingly popular in the 1960s. These activists, from both the Black and white church traditions, preached and practiced at least a dozen dangerous ideas. Here are just a few of them. The civil rights movement stressed the inviolable dignity of persons, which was not the same as the rights of individuals. For most civil rights activists, the dignity of human beings was God-given. For others, it was just a given. Civil rights activists also expressed the radical idea that religion means something on days besides Sunday. They agreed with Martin Luther King that the contemporary church is often a weak, ineffectual voice with an uncertain sound. They condemned the compartmentalization of American life, which relegates religion to the personal and private realm. But they also believed that in God's creation, the arc of the moral universe bends toward justice. And they had faith that people of faith, called not to sanction things as they are, but to make things as they should be, would also bend themselves to create the kingdom of God on earth. The civil rights movement also contended that we are responsible not just for our words, but for our world, and not just for part of it. The civil rights leadership thought that justice was the operative principle of Christianity, because justice was love in action. Inaction, therefore, was unacceptable. Civil rights leaders knew that the law didn't always guarantee justice, and that, in fact, sometimes the law guaranteed injustice. In such a situation, they believed it was the moral obligation of good people to break the law. A third dangerous idea of the civil rights movement, therefore, is that jail is sometimes the right place to be. Thousands of civil rights activists went to jail for breaking the law. Sometimes civil rights activists thought, it may be criminal not to be criminal. On the anniversary of Martin Luther King's birth, it's important for us to remember that our tradition includes the prophetic character and characters of American culture, including a religious radicalism that has much to teach us today.
You've been listening to James Farrell, author of The Spirit of the 60s. This is Talking History.
The upper room where
for our site of the week, we continue on our subject, Martin Luther King Jr., and suggest to you a site long associated with the slain civil rights leader. Here to tell you about this historic site is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
The National Civil Rights Museum is the first and only comprehensive overview of the civil rights movement in exhibit form. Located in the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, where Dr. King was assassinated on April 4, 1968, the museum presents a timeline of the civil rights struggle relating to African Americans and concentrating on the seminal events of the 50s and 60s, including the Montgomery bus boycott, Brown versus Board of Education, the March on Washington, among others. The museum opened in September of 1991 and holds many annual events, including the National Civil Rights Museum's Freedom Award ceremony in September, a King Day celebration, as well as a commemoration in April of his death with special remembrances of the legacy of Martin Luther King, Jr.
Turning to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, clearly you enjoy history. Why else would you be listening? But have you ever stopped to think about who are our historians? Can a scholar who is labeled by many as a Holocaust denier be considered an historian? Or should university history professors be more concerned with writing books or educating students? Have you ever considered the origins and impact of historical myths, where they come from, and how they mold our understanding of the past? Pretty heavy stuff, but also very interesting, enough so that the History Channel will air a forum on all of these questions involving some of the nation's top historians on January 23rd as part of its History Center series. If you're up for something a little lighter, check out the History Channel series History Alive. On Monday through Thursday, January 24th through the 27th, History Alive will air a series of programs on ancient Egypt titled Mummies, Tales from Egyptian Crypts. Be sure to check your local listings for exact times. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you will join us next week when we will take a look at Paris Noir, or the experience of African Americans in Paris. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.
I wish I had the power to be free. I wish I could break on a change for you. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole wide world.